And unfortunately, right at that time, the product was pulled from the shelves because kids were doing things wrong with the little ovens. They would put the ovens in the toilet and they'd fry the cells, they'd pour water on it, or they did things where they'd put things in there that would cook and, you know, asphyxiate the kid in the bedroom. And so they took them off the shelves. It was no longer legal to sell the ovens and stuff. And they tried to redo the product with plastic molds and a light bulb, and that didn't click. They just failed. To this day, Mike, I still have molds and stuff. And they have 1964 on each one of the molds, and Mattel 1964. So it's obviously a collector's item that I still love or whatever. I have to have them myself. But anyways, that's kind of the demise of the whole thing. Eventually, I couldn't get the goop. I ordered the goop for the next 4 or 5 months, and they'd bring it to me. And eventually, they came to me and said, look, it's no longer available. I said, what? You know, I can't get the goop. So I tried other things in the molds. I would try everything I could think of to try to make my product because I still had a demand for it. So I was pouring glue, and I'd pour rubber cement, and I tried different things and try to get it back out of the mold. And eventually, I had to give up because it seemed like it was just a lost case. I couldn't make it work anymore.
Were you ever able to make for the fishing guy?
I did. I made orders for him. I was cranking them out. But I had to go to my dad at the time. He went to work, you know, Mattel, and he would buy 100 molds with the one with the worm on it. You know, so he was able to get out of production line or whatever. He'd probably bribe somebody or did something he had to do to get somebody to sell us out of the kit. You know, they'd sell you 6 different molds in an oven. Well, now he's taking the molds right off the production line, 100 at a time for the different elements that I needed, you know, grasshoppers and crickets and worms and whatever it is, spiders and things that were now in my production or whatever. So I'd have 100 worms cooking at one time, all different colors, all different rainbows and everything else to try to get what this guy wanted. He's coming to me and saying, can you make them green? Can you make them white? You know, he's onto the concept that different colors work better as different lures or whatever. But anyway, so I was doing that, and that's when they took him off the shelf, and there's a big scare. And my dad says, that's not my kid. He's got a grill. He's working on a regular restaurant grill. He's not working with the oven, so that's not a threat. You know, so he says, just be careful and don't burn yourself. And, you know, I was already onto it by that time. They get very hot. You know, little molds get almost red hot when they're cooking, so they would hurt kids. You know, they'd drop them on their lap or something or whatever, drop them on their brother or whatever, so that the kids were hurting themselves out there. And, you know, I was on the different elements. I said, oh, no, we're going to make things out of this.
That's very good. Can you remember what you got to do with the money and what kind of money you were making at 8 years old?
My parents mostly took it. We were very poor, as I mentioned, you know, so a lot of it went away to clothes and school and different things that my sisters need. And they would tell me, you know, the same story over and over. We're going to give this back to you, and we'll save this for a college fund or something. But basically, they scammed and took my money from me, you know, every chance they could. And it kept me out of trouble because my favorite things in life were bubble gum and different things.
Yeah, but what a great story. That was a true manufacturing business. What could someone who wants to make money today, what kind of lessons could they take from your very first manufacturing business as an 8-year-old kid? What are some of the benefits of that specific business, maybe in relationship to low manufacturing costs, to margins,
yeah, so
stuff like
I
that?
I think the most important thing is secure the future of it so you can control whatever elements make up your money. It reminds you of the story of Henry Ford, where he was making the first Model A's and stuff with the crate that they sent him. You know, they used to send him a crate full of parts, you know, the different bearings and stuff, and he would take the crate, and that became the model for the car. He actually took the crates that they were sending him in.
Who was sending them the crates?
The manufacturers that were making the parts that he couldn't make at Ford.
Oh, so Ford was buying parts when he first started.
When he first started, he bought parts, and they came in this big wooden crate, you know, the size of a chassis of a car, and he would use that crate and cut the doors out and make it so that that's actually the frame of the car was the crate. And he never told anybody, you know, so he just started to do it. And it's really interesting that the other thing he did, as he cuts the crate apart, he would cut out the doors, cut out the trunk, and then make all the parts around it so that it makes it into a Model A. But he'd take all the parts that he cut out, and he very carefully would cut them into small little boards, and then he would charcoal them, he'd burn them and then put them out, and then that became the first Kingsford charcoal briquettes. And it's actually King Ford is the production for that. And they would put the charcoal briquettes in the cars that they sold so you could take it for a picnic. That was the first purpose the cars to the country, you know, so they can have a picnic. And they use a little Ford charcoal briquettes that were made out of the crate, and they would be driving in the crate itself, and they didn't realize it. And then later, the guys found out that we're sending them the parts and the crates, and they says, hey, look, we're going to change the size of the crate unless you pay us money. And somehow or another, he secured his ability to get them to continue to sell them in the crates, or he would stop the production. He would stop their buying, you know, so he'd buy it from somebody that was going to give him that crate, you know, so that became a big issue at the first Fords or whatever, that he couldn't work out that particular detail without being put over the barrel. You know, Ford, when he first started doing his cars, he made $4 off every car. The profit level was $4. Is that amazing or what? Nowadays you make $4 off a lug nut, you know what I'm saying? I mean, come on. You know, every single part of the car is mass money, you know, so the profit margin is so high, but the first one's only $4. And of course you made millions, so you made $4 million. If you ask the most important thing, I think, is to secure whatever it is that you need so that nobody can hold you over the barrel later. That seems to be a big thing in production for big companies. They'll buy the fuels of rubber plants so that you can't hold the rubber over them later.
You gotta be the manufacturer. You gotta be the source.
Yes, you have to create and be the source, or you're going to be vulnerable to them increasing whatever it is that makes them richer and you poorer because they got you over a barrel. So I think that's one of the most important things. You have to secure whatever elements that are making up your bottom line. That's an important factor that most people don't consider, you know. And if it's successful, whatever you're doing, someone's going to catch wind of it and realize it and then raise your numbers so that you're going to be at their mercy. Oh, you need water, Diaz. That's a great example, too. They need so much water for Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola that they actually buy a water source. And, you know, now they make water bottled by Nestle and they sell it to you at the regular rate as a Coke. You know, it's just one of those things where as soon as they see a new source of water, Nestle and Coke are right there first to be the first buyers of it because they need so much of it, you know, fresh water to bottle for their sodas.
Let's tie this in. Be the manufacturer. So your inspiration by Jackson Pollock in the early days in the museum, you started painting as well, correct?
Yes. After a while, I was an artist for years, a sculptor, and eventually I found it too demanding on my body. Someone would say, how much is the cost of the sculpture right here? And I say, everything's determined on the risk to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Let's do the story about the guy who came into your shop and you learned about the demand for this bear or this sculpture and then how you got into that.
I had a store. It was in Pacific Beach, California. It was a store, and it was one of the most fascinating stores on the West Coast. People came from miles around from L.A. to New York, and they came in, and some of them sought out the store. They said, we heard about this place. We want to see it.
What was it called?
It was called the Mad Mall.
What was the address of it?
It was on Garnett Avenue. It was probably about the 1400 block. It was right across the street from Henry's. Is it called Henry's, the food place?
Henry's Market.
Yes, and then they changed the name, of course, to the new one now. But I was right there on the corner of Fanwell and Garnett Avenue. It was 6 blocks from the bay, 6 blocks from the beach, because I intended to make it a place where he can have lots of toys and go play at the beach or play at the bay in my boats and stuff. And so that was the first concept, was to have this store. Anyway, do you want to hear about how I got started with that store or what?
Let's do the sculpture story and we'll go back to how you got started.
Okay. I had a store that had amazing products. I had at least 10,000 items hanging from the ceiling alone on piano wires. That was one of my things that made it interesting. As you walk in and the whole room was free-floating items in midair, and I had thousands of items on the floor and in shelves and on the counters, and it was just a full store that would make you just eye pop. You know, and people came in the store and they do a circle with their eyes and they say, wow, and if they didn't do that, I'd get angry at the guys that were working for me. I had 10 men working for me at the time, and I'd say, hey, listen, guys, that guy didn't go wow, you know, make some more things and put more interesting things from the ceiling. You know, we had everything you could conceive of hanging upside down from the ceilings, like you're in the center of a mirrored image, you know. So one of the things I had on the ceiling that was kind of a challenge to put up there, because I had big beams that went across and they were able to hoist with enough different points that it would make it so that it wasn't too much stress on any one wire, you know. So I had a baby grand piano hanging upside down from the ceiling, and I sold that about every couple months. Someone would come in and say, I have to have that. It was fascinating to me that things that were hanging from the ceiling, sometimes upside down, they were actually sold faster than the things on the ground that were the same exact item. So, you know, it's some sort of weird thing where people see that and say, wow, I really love that thing. And then when they get it down to the ground or get it to their home, they say, you know what, it doesn't hold the same value as it did in the store when I bought it, because now it looks different. You know, I didn't understand that I was using the artist eye and the concept of composition. When I painted and did things with art, you have to use composition. There's maybe triangulation, you know, where you have a certain part of the painting pulls your eye here and then it goes to here and then here. I realized as a child that artists manipulated your mind and your eye because of your perspective to get you to draw all around the painting or whatever. The real masters were good at moving your mind around so that they can get what they wanted to achieve. So if you look at great pieces of art, they're actually done usually mathematically, and at a distance you realize that you're being pulled around with your eye mentally, you know, psychologically. So I did the same thing with my store on a huge scale. I'd say, no, put it right there and make it like this, and the guys would listen to what I said or whatever, and they'd put it up there like that, upside down, at an angle or something. For whatever reason, that was more aesthetically pleasing. You'd look at it and say, wow, that's amazing. But when it's down on the ground, under your level of eye, it doesn't look the same. It's been altered. So that was one of the tricks or whatever to the trade, was to get people to walk in the room, and I can move their mind, or I can watch their face face and their eyes and say, they're looking at the right place. Now they're moving over there. I can see they've gone there and they've covered the whole room mentally before they even taken one step into the store. So it's interesting. The different elements that made up the store were fascinating to me. You know, how people buy psychologically. You walk around a room usually counterclockwise and you end up with the cash registers right next to the door and you buy that purchase. And most stores are set up the same way. Of course, since stores have been made since, you know, thousands of years, that people have analyzed and figured out that the direction to buy is this direction. So they actually walk around the room in a certain way and take in the perception a certain way and purchase and buy and then walk out. So other guys have taken advantage of that. You know, Montgomery Ward's and Sears and everybody else figures that out and says, we're going to set it up like this with the cash register right here. It's not just a random thing. You never see a cash register in the back of a store. Obviously, they want to catch you right at the point of entry or point of exit. Anyway, so there's a lot of study involved with all of it. I'd learned it by myself just trying to analyze and figure it out. So I had thousands of items in my store, and this little American Indian, a native from the north, came into my store, and he had a tarp, and he set this thing down in the middle of the store. He had the long hair and tattoos and things that showed that he was a tribesman, you know, from far in the north. And I love anything Native American. Was fascinating to me, and it still is. And so he had this thing. He says, hey, mister, take a look at this. And he unveiled it. You know, I had a tarp wrapped around it. He unveiled it, and it was a little wooden bear that was made with a chainsaw, and it was about 3 feet tall, and it was fascinating. It had fur and eyes, and the whole thing was just an amazing piece of accomplished art. And somebody came in right then and says, wow, this is cool. Mike, how much is that? And I said, wait a minute. The whole store, you see this thing of all 10,000 items upside down or not? You know, they said, yeah, that's the coolest thing in here. And so they purchased it right on the spot for $500 from the native, and I thought maybe somebody had sent that guy in from around the corner. I thought it was called the shill, you know, where the guy came in and says, I'll take it, and later they work out the deal between them, you know, they give him his money back or whatever to the native, just to show that they sell quickly, so that way I might be interested in making an order for some, you know. So I thought, the guy was just sending around the corner or whatever. He's a shill, he's a setup, you know. So right then one of my customers came in that I've known for 10 years, and they said, wow, that's amazing, how much is it? And before the native could say anything, I says, it's $700. And they says, well, I'll take it. And so I increased it by $200, almost 50%, and they wanted it. And I looked at the native. I says, you got any more on the truck? He says, no, that was the last one. I was dumbfounded because why would you bring in something to somebody you're going to sell to them and only have one of them?
How old were you?
I was probably 22 at the time, you know, then 23. So I says, you know, you got to have more of these things. He says, well, I got more, but they're 1,000 miles north where the border of Oregon and California come together. And I said, let's go get them, you know. So I packed up a truck and up we went. You know, I took some of my guys and we went to the north to go obtain these items that this native had made, you know, saying because they were so quickly sold. Anyway, so I found myself finding other ones that were made by non-natives. They get closer and closer up there in the hills. There's lots of guys that make them, you know, with the chainsaw. They make art. And I would buy every single piece I seen, you know, no matter what. I'd have to have it, you know, because I needed a big demand for the store, you know. So I got so focused on it that eventually I gave up the store and just started to chase down the sculptures because they were so fascinating and there's so many variables and there's such a unique item that I would just start to sell those, you know. And at some point I ended up with a lot that I rented and I would pull in with the truck and they were tarped. I'd put a tarp around each one so they wouldn't scratch against each other. And I would take them off the truck and they still had the tarp tied on it. And the people were purchasing there that were waiting for me. They'd give me $500 or $400, depending on what I wanted. And they don't even know what the item is. They see that it's a piece of wood with something in towel wrapped around it, and they say, I got to have it. So I simply pulled them off the truck and sold them faster than they can even look at what it is.
There was nothing like this in San Diego, right?
No, and there's no such piece of wood like that. And people here love wood, and they don't have it. There's not wood items that you can obtain anywhere in San Diego. So everything's stucco, brick, and rock, you know. So here's this unique, and it was actually California redwood. So as I took them off the truck, they trusted and knew enough to just grab it up and buy it before there's any increase of rate or someone else might get it. So they were buying wrapped up towels and wrapped up cushions that had items inside of it. And so then they buy it from me for $400, $500, $600. They'd untie it and then, wow, look at, I got a bear. Wow, look at, I got an eagle. And I remember only one time where one of the persons traded their Native American face for a bear. They said, oh, I really like yours. And the other one says, I really like yours. So they traded right there on the spot. But other than that, I can't remember anybody being dissatisfied with whatever they were getting. It was just an amazing accomplishment to drop on the ground and sell something without even being seen. Whatever it was for $500, there's a lot of money involved. And they were totally happy with it. They'd take their animal, whatever it was, and walk away and say, all right, you know, I got one. And then I would immediately take off to go get more. And I'd spend 2 days driving, 1 day selling, 2 days driving. And I had my men on the lot that were there to receive and have the people ready to go. You know, they'd have them in the line and ready to buy up this item. And eventually I would go to the north, back to the people that were buying them from, either they were natives or white people along the side of the road making them up. And I'd bought out every single piece. There was no more people to buy them from because most of them would get $10,000 in their hand from me buying their products from them, and they'd leave. They said this is the first opportunity in 5 years that they get to get out of this town, so they would take off. And I'd get there and there'd be nothing left. I said, where'd the guy go? The artist that was here. Oh, he took off. Some idiot paid him a couple grand or $10,000. He's out of here, man. Like, he's wanting to go back to Detroit or Idaho or Nebraska or wherever they're from. And they'd say, damn. So I was buying myself out of my own product. I couldn't find anything to purchase anymore, you know.
Were your margins good? I mean, were you buying at a right price?
Oh, yeah. And turning right over. Because up in the north, the only way to describe it, the highways and byways that I was buying off of, maybe two cars a day would pass by. And then I take it down to my lot where 20,000 cars pass by. So the exposure was so much increased. And I always made it a point never to burn the artist for the numbers. Whatever they told me they wanted for it, I'd give it to them. I didn't even argue or anything else. It was $50, $100, whatever it was. I'd say, here you go. And I'd buy every piece so that even the ones that weren't so good or the ones that were only half finished, I would purchase them also because I wanted to show the artist that I was devout enough to buy every piece that he was making so they would make more. You know, they sit down with other pieces of wood and say, all right, I got $5,000 in my hand. I want to make more. I could buy new saws. I could buy wood. I could buy a new truck, whatever they needed. And they all needed everything. Every one of them always had needs. And I would show up and, all right, here comes our savior. You know, here's the guy that's going to buy every piece I got. But anyway, one of the first pieces I purchased, I got to tell you real quick, was a piece that was 30 feet tall. It was this huge, giant monster. It was a giant native face. I was already in love with the first bears, and when I got up to the north, he took me to the place where he was making more. He says, look at this one, and he showed me this piece. It was absolutely enormous. It was between 25 and 30 feet tall, and I says, oh my God, I have to have that thing, you know, and it wasn't finished. He says, oh, it's nowhere near done. I says, it's done enough, you know, so that's a fascinating piece that someone will pay a lot of money for. So we put it on the back of a low bed semi. I had to have a crane lifted up and set on the semi, and they laid it down, and they put a big tarp over it so they could take it down the freeway, and I only made it to L.A. I went from the north down the south. I drove 700 miles, made it to L.A., and I was in a truck that has wide load on the top of it, you know, so I can follow the truck in front of me because the piece stuck out 5 feet off each end of the trailer, you know, so it's taking up almost two lanes. Anyway, so I'm chasing it with the chase truck, and it has a big sign above me that says wide load, you know, big flags and blinking lights and stuff. Anyway, Rolls Royce pulled in between me and the truck and started honking at the big semi. I can see the guy's got his hand out the window. He's saying, pull over, pull over. So I thought, oh, shoot, a piece of it must have fell off and hit that Rolls Royce. So I said, here we go. We're going to have to pay for damage on this car because something fell off the big rig. Anyway, so he pulled over on the side of the freeway. It was Freeway 10 up there. And the guy pulls us over, and the car's going by 70 miles an hour. And the guy jumps out of his Rolls, and he goes up to the piece and says, oh, my God, that's fascinating. And all he's looking at is the bottom of the log. He's looking at the thousands of lines that make up the years of the growth. And he's looking at the log. There's not even a tarp exposed enough to tell what it is. He says, what is that thing? What is it? And I says, it's a sculpture. Of what? A big Native American face. He says, I have to have it. I have to have it right now. And I had paid $7,000 for it from the guy up in the north. And I says, well, you know, you don't even know what the thing is or what it's worth. He says, I don't care. I have to have it. So I says, it's 30 grand. So he says, okay, I'll take it. So he bought it sight unseen for $30,000. And I says, where's it going to go? He says, I live out in Lancaster, out in the desert, you know, straight out from L.A. So I turned to the driver. I says, you're paid to get down to San Diego. Would you take it to Lancaster? He says, sure. I don't care one way or the other. So he took it out to Lancaster to this guy's estate. And there it sits to this day. I don't know where. The guy gave me 30 grand for it. And he gave me a check, and I didn't trust it. So I made him drive with me to the bank so he could cash it. So I took the 30 grand and I immediately went back north and tried to buy more, you know. So that was the start of the craziness.
Oh, you must have been excited. Okay, so we're going to go back to your lesson. You got to have control. At what point did you run out of product to where you decided to go into your own manufacturing, just like you did with the creepy crawlers?
Yes, well, I was going north to buy pieces with the 30 Gs, and I started on that point to buy from every person that I've seen. I said, this thing's so amazing that I have to have every one of them. So at some point, I would have to drive 750 miles just to see the first one. Going from San Diego through L.A., unfortunately, all the way up to the north, 700 miles, and then there would be the first guy. I says, what happened to the other 30 guys that were down south? They're out of here. It's hard to find the wood. It's hard to obtain the wood to make the piece because it's up in the north. And then the market's down in the south. And so I learned that right away. I says, well, obviously you got to drive these things to the south to get exposure, to get the people that don't know what wood is or to be excited about it. And at the same time, the wood was hard to obtain in the north. So it was a perplexing situation where eventually I went back to the native that I bought the 30-foot piece from, and I was buying his 10-foot, 15-foot, whatever he had. I was buying the pieces from him, and he had taken money up front. One of the mistakes, I guess, but at the same time, it was imperative that I had more pieces, so I would leave cash on the barrelhead to come back to obtain more pieces. I say, here's $5,000. Go ahead and start on the next ones. I remember one time, I got to tell you really quick, one time I handed him $5,000 up front for a piece, and one of the little natives from his tribe comes up and he's crying. The little native kid is crying. He's about 6 years old. And he says, what's wrong? And he says, well, my mom, she's sick and she's got to get medicine. So he hands him the $5,000. And the little kid's running away, and I remember seeing money peeling off and a handful of cash. As actually, as he's running, he's losing bills behind him. I asked the Indian, I said, why would you do that? You know, I said, he says, ah, it comes, it goes. No big deal. So he had no value to the money, or didn't care, you know. So he says, ah, his mother's sick, let him fix him, you know. So I said, man, that's amazing. Of course, I was 100% behind whatever he thought. It was just great to me. So I purchased every piece that he had, and I went ahead and started pre-buying, and I went back up one day, and he was gone. He had buried one of the broken saws. He actually had cut a hole into one of the pieces and buried the saw stuck in there with the bar, or stuck in with the blade. And he put a little sign underneath there that says, make your own piece, white man.
Really?
Yeah, he was gone. He, you know, probably had $50,000 of my money in his pocket, and he's out of here, you know. So I couldn't blame him. I didn't diss him for it or whatever. I says, ah, you know, it's the first time he had an opportunity to get out of that town, and, you know, he's rich, and he's got everything he's wanted, everything he can accomplish, you know. So later I ran into him. It was really fascinating, wonderful story. I ran into him. Anyway, so I wanted to bring him and everything that's involved with him, you know, we made up or whatever for the fact that he burned me, and he was broke again, and he's, you know, says, would you buy another piece? And I said, sure, you know, whatever you got, you know, make it. He had this amazing teepee. He had made this teepee with 30-foot logs. There was 30 logs and 30-foot tall. It's the biggest teepee I've ever seen in my life, and biggest teepee most people have ever seen in their life. It was made out of huge telephone poles. You know, I mean, this thing was just a monster piece, and it was 30 feet across on the bottom. It was up in the snow up where he was from, and he says, I'm working on this, and he was painting a giant buffalo outline around the back of it with red paint, and he's covering the whole thing with different paintings. And I says, man, that is amazing. He says, that's my lodge. That's what I live in. And I says, no way. So he says, come on inside. Take a look inside. So it's actually a round door that has stitches that holds it closed, and it's all made out of buffalo hide. The whole thing was actually really buffalo hide that he obtained and made this thing up. So I stepped through the hole of the door, and the only way to describe it is 30 feet tall, 30 feet across, and in the center of it is a giant raging fire made with pallets. And it's snow on the outside, but absolutely warm and toasty on the inside. And it has a big tarp that goes across the floor and then up 1 foot around all the poles. It's up and tied or nailed to the poles all the way around, 1 foot up. And the outside of the teepee goes all the way to the ground. And by doing that or whatever, there's a space in between there where air and oxygen comes into the teepee to feed the fire, and it all goes up straight through the top of the teepee. It's a big fluke that it goes right out of, and it's actually the way that all of them are designed across the Midwest. And I says, oh, man, this is amazing. And on the inside of it, I could describe it real quick because he lived there, and it's a modern-day Native American. He had wall-to-wall carpets, mostly Persian rugs. It was three big fold-out couches that made up the places where they actually lived and slept on. And all the poles that were all the way to the top of the teepee were carved. Every inch of it was sculpted into different images. You know, there was wolves and feathers and all sorts of wonderful native things, eagles, and all this carved into the wall. And then in between it was hanging a canvas that he had painted in between each one of the poles all the way around, and they had painted onto the canvas. So the whole thing was just art inside and out, and at the same time it was a sunken little kitchen inside of the kitchenette, sunken into the ground about a foot so that you stepped out into it, and it had a big cauldron stuck in the ground through a big piece of pipe, and it swung around into the fire, and it would swing out, and there's his wife, and she swings out the cauldron, and she says, are you hungry? I've got dinner out here. And I said, what do you got? And I look in there, and there's some hoofs sticking out of it. It's actually a deer hoof was sticking out of the pot. And she says, I got some venison, some deer. And I said, well, I got to have that, you know. So we're eating it, you know, we're enjoying this wonderful view. And I'm looking up, and one of the things that was happening is the fire would lick, you know, as the fire cooks and licks up into the air, all the images on the teepee would move around. All the carved images, so it actually was alive. The whole thing was just like it had flickers, and it would make all the faces move, and different things would coagulate together, and all the images on the walls would change, you know, as you sit there looking at it. And then right then he did a chant. he did this, it gave me shivers even right now. It gives me shivers to think about what I was looking at. You know, the inside of this teepee was so fascinating, and to see all the things were so hard to take in, that what I did is I said, listen, man, we got to take this thing to San Diego. I got a lot right on PB Drive. It was actually right on PB Drive where it comes together with La Jolla Boulevard right there. It's actually across the street from the promenade. I'd rented this huge, giant lot. And I said, we need to move this teepee down to the lot. He says, what? And I says, listen, I want to do a deal where you can make whatever you want. You can carve and sell whatever you want. I don't want any money for any of it. I'll bring wood to you. And at the same time, I want to charge people $5 to see the teepee. And I want the gate, you know, I want the money off the TPC, and at the same time you can sell and do whatever you want. He says, man, it's freezing cold up here, I'd love to be down at the beach. So we moved the entire teepee, and the whole entire setup was down to PB, and by the time we got it set up, there was a line around the block. People come from the beach and seen it going on, and they came across and lined up. I have pictures of the line in the beginning of the setup or whatever, because I couldn't believe people already lined up. I said, this is not going to be ready for hours. They said, we don't care. We want to see it. You know, they got money in hand. They're running the $5 out and around, right? You know, we started bringing people in, and they walk in the teepee, and they walk out the other side and be fascinated by what they're looking at and all the different images. And he's carving away and making pieces and brought down pieces from the north that I already had carved, and he's making 100% profit, which is okay for me. And one of the people in line, there was a woman standing there with a clipboard in her hand. And I thought, oh, God, here we go. There must be some city ordinance that I'm probably breaking or whatever. And she's here to give me tickets or write me up or do something because she looked like an official person. So anyway, she's standing in line. So I went up to her before she can pay her $5 to go into the teepee. I says, ma'am, can I help you? And she says, no, I just want to talk to the artist. And I says, well, I kind of talked for him because he's busy sculpting and stuff. I don't want him to be interrupted while he's working. You know, is there any way that I can talk to you and deal with whatever the situation is? Because I still thought it was a negative at the time. I thought she was going to give us a ticket or write us up or correct us for whatever we're doing wrong. And she says, well, I just want to talk to him for just a minute. I'm a promoter, and I want to buy some of his art. I want to see if he'll do a deal with me. And I said, well, I don't want to slow him down from that potential opportunity. So I called him over, and they went and talked in the back of the teepee for a few minutes by the trucks or whatever. And she comes back out, and he says, oh, my God, I just swung a deal. And up until then, I was probably paying him $500 a week, you know, saying he was making at least $500 a week or $500 for a couple of days to do his art the first 2 days we're there. And he says, I just swung a deal with that lady. I says, what do you mean? He says, well, she owns the Indian casino. She has something to do with promoting Indian casinos, and she wants to pay me $1,000 a day to go around to the Indian casinos and do grand openings with the same thing.
Wow.
And I said, son of a gun. I said, well, I don't want to slow you down. I said, there it is. You know, obviously all your dreams are met. You know, his eyes are lit up. He's excited, and he's going to get a grand a day. I says, you know, if you save a grand a day for 3 years, you're a millionaire. And he laughs. He says, oh, my God, Mike, you fucking made my life. How can I repay? And I says, well, if you make a piece every once in a while, let me buy it from you just so I can show it at my stores or promotions or whatever. So he went off with her, and they end up carving and doing his show as they went. And they opened up all the casinos, the Pala, the Barona, and all the different ones. And he ended up over in Hawaii, where they're opening up some sort of big thing over in Hawaii. And the natives fell in love with him. The first time they see him, first of all, he's tall. He's about 6 feet tall.
What's his name?
His name is Laban Harper, but unfortunately I've tried 1,000 times to go chase him down to see what happened. And unfortunately, making $1,000 a day, a lot of people fall to temptations. So he ended up drinking and doing drugs and bad things or whatever, helping him to his health. And he ended up hurting his back, and he got to the point where he couldn't work anymore. So she discharged him or whatever, broke the contract because he couldn't fulfill it. And he ended up back in a hotel broke. So I heard about him being in this hotel, so I chased it down. This is 500 miles to the north. And I found him. I says, Laban, what's going on, man? Where you been? What you up to? And I thought, because he's broke again, another time in his life, at least 3 or 4 times that I come up on him, he's destitute. So he immediately is hitting me up for some cash, and I gave him some money, of course. And right then he was sitting down. I got to tell really quick. He's sitting down, and he's carving with a knife an antler. He has an antler from an elk. And what he did is he carved it into a perfect proportional letter opener with the handle being sculpted into a bear's face. And I said, oh, my God, that's fascinating. Look at that piece of art. You know, and it's all antler, so it looks like a bone, or it looks like it's all white ivory or whatever. But he's scratching away at it, carving away. And he also had a little Native American face that he made out of the same antler down a little further. And so I says, oh, man, that is so cool. And right then, one of the things with natives is they love big giant women that do all the work. Native men usually just sit around and the women do all the cooking, cleaning, chores, the kids. So he had this woman that was his new wife, his new adopted wife or whatever, and she was a monster. She was like 300 pounds of romping, stomping orangutan, you know. So
and
that kept him in check to the point where he's still alive anyway. And he's in a back brace and he's sitting in a chair and he can't get up and he's got a beer in his hand and I'm throwing money at him. And he shows me the carving. He says, you can have that if you want. And I says, oh, cool, man. So I had a hold of the piece or whatever and I set it on the table. I'm looking at it on the coffee table and we're talking for a few minutes. And he turns to her. She's in the kitchen and she's kind of a little bit down or distraught about me being there for some reason. Maybe she thought I was going to bring some negative influence into his life or something. But basically, she's kind of like negative, being in the kitchen, growling and stuff. And he turns to her and he says, honey, I got to go out. Mike and I are going to go out and talk for a minute. She says, you're not going nowhere. And I can hear her yell from the kitchen. She says, oh, no, I'm going out, woman. I'm going. See ya. You know, so he goes and he walks through the door for the hotel room. And I'm right behind him. And before I can make it out of the door, that letter opener comes flying across the room and sticks into the frame of the door.
Whoa. She chunked it?
She threw it at him and it missed him by instant. She wanted to hit the wall and wanted to hit the door jamb, and it did, and it stuck right in there. And he turns around, he comes back in the room, he goes, God damn it, woman, and he takes the thing and pulls it out of the wall, but it had broken the tip. And by breaking the tip off of it in order to keep it proportional, he now has to carve the whole thing over again a half an inch shorter. He's pissed as hell. He says, damn it, now you broke it. You know. Anyway, so that was my last connection with him. I left and I was going to come back, and she had moved him out of the hotel room. They went someplace, I don't know where.
We've ended part two of our interview with Mike, the garage sale guy. Please continue to part three.